Hello, and welcome to this Microsoft TechNet session on disaster recovery in Exchange 2007. Let's start this session by going into detail on what we'll be covering. Today, we're going to talk about disaster recovery in Microsoft Exchange Server 2007. During the session, we'll discuss how you can plan for disaster recovery by understanding what can go wrong with your Exchange servers and the information they store and handle. We'll look at server roles, what each server role does, and what will happen to your Exchange organization when a server role fails. Obviously, we don't want to wait until a problem occurs before fixing it, so during the session, we'll talk about what you can do to avoid problems in the first place, such as planning redundancy into the organization, providing adequate backup, and implementing fault tolerance. When a disaster occurs, you'll need to get the server up and running as quickly as possible, so during the session, we'll also look at the recovery solutions and tools available. At the end of the session, we will run through a number of demonstrations to show some of these fault-tolerant features and recovery tools in action. As with most TechNet sessions, some prior experience of Microsoft technologies or similar technologies is always helpful. Next is a brief overview of what would be helpful, but not essential, for this session. As we go through today's session, you will hear various Microsoft acronyms and terminology. While we will explain all new terms related to today's session, there are some general terms from the industry or from other versions of Microsoft products that we may not spend time on. To help you out, we have listed the areas that it may be helpful to be familiar with, either prior to this session or to reference afterwards. It would be helpful to have some IT administration experience with Microsoft Exchange Server 2003, Exchange 2000 Server, or Exchange Server 5.5. To cover the topics mentioned and keep the session flow going, we have divided the session up into the following agenda items. There are four main topics we'll discuss today. We'll start by identifying the Exchange server roles and what they do. This will help us understand the impact of a server failure on the messaging infrastructure. Next, we'll take a look at where the information is in Exchange and how to protect that information. We'll also talk about the fault-tolerant features of Exchange Server 2007 and how they can help prevent failures from becoming disasters. Then we'll take a look at what disasters can occur and how to mitigate the effects of them. Finally, we'll look at the disaster recovery tools and how they can assist in a speedy recovery when needed. But before we start today's session, let's have a quick reminder of the design goals for Exchange Server 2007. As email systems have evolved, they have become more complex and harder to manage. Users require access to their mailboxes from anywhere and from a variety of devices. Because of the importance of email within an organization, compromises to the security and availability of email systems can have detrimental effects on an organization. Previous versions of Exchange ran on 32-bit operating systems. Computers that run 32-bit operating systems are limited to 4 gigabytes of memory. This limitation can lead to poor performance on busy servers. Exchange Server 2007 runs on 64-bit versions of Windows Server 2003. 64-bit operating systems can access very large amounts of memory. This extra memory allows for larger mailbox databases and improved server performance. Exchange 2007 supports new data protection mechanisms, including local continuous replication, or LCR, and clustered continuous replication, or CCR. In LCR, the Exchange server maintains a duplicate of a storage group on another volume in the same server. In CCR, another server maintains a copy of the storage group. A process called log shipping synchronizes the storage group copies. We'll look at both LCR and CCR later in today's session. Exchange 2007 also provides improved message security and regulatory compliance features, which allows you to establish sender, recipient, connection, and content-based anti-spam filters, determine sender reputation dynamically so that the system can detect attacks, create transport rules to inspect and act on messages traveling through the organization. These rules can modify, encrypt, or route the messages in a particular way. Define storage rules that allow message retention for regulatory conformance. In addition, the computer running Exchange Server automatically updates smart screens to ensure up-to-the-minute anti-spam protection and encrypts all messages by default for added security. Smart screen technology enables Exchange Server to distinguish between legitimate email messages and unsolicited commercial email or other spam. The main focus for today's session will be on improvements to Exchange Server availability. Let's return to the agenda. Exchange Server 2007 supports 5 server roles. Only one of these roles actually stores information. The other server roles handle the information in transit or perform other functions related to client access, message routing, and message delivery. In this first section, we'll discuss these server roles and how they fit together to provide the basis of your messaging infrastructure. First, let's run through the basics. Server roles fall into one of 2 broad categories. One role is designed to be deployed in the perimeter network outside the corporate intranet with no access to Active Directory. The other roles are designed to be installed inside the intranet with access to Active Directory. The server in the perimeter network, called an edge transport server, is isolated from Active Directory and functions as a message hygiene and routing engine. It's responsible for filtering messages as they arrive from untrusted networks like the internet. Although it is not part of your Active Directory forest, to ensure that it can deliver messages to the correct recipient, it needs access to Active Directory information, which is provided by an instance of Active Directory Application Mode, or ADAM, installed locally and synchronized with an instance within your intranet. This role can't be combined with others, as that would compromise security to some extent. Connectors are used to route messages to and from the intranet. Message routing within the intranet, or between trusted organizations, is handled by the hub transport server. This role can be combined with others where required. The client access server role enables non-MAPI clients like POP, IMAP, and Outlook Anywhere to connect to Exchange. It functions like a front-end server does in 2003, without all the mailbox and routing elements to slow things down. The mailbox server is more like the traditional Exchange server that we saw in 2003, with an information store and associated public and private stores. However, it doesn't handle non-MAPI client access or message routing, as these are handled by the other roles. By breaking a single server into distinct functional units, storage, routing, and access, the system works better, with a server able to focus on the given task. The unified messaging server is new. It lets you combine email with both voicemail and fax services. When you install a unified messaging server, you give your users a unified inbox. It links your PBX system with Exchange, handles phone calls, and provides answering services as well as voicemail. Now we'll put the whole thing together and step through the roles one at a time. Let's think about a message that arrives at your organization. The edge transport server sits isolated in the perimeter network, routing messages to and from the internet. Messages are filtered using agents, like the connection filtering agent, which accepts or rejects SMTP connections from remote hosts based on IP address. Messages are also filtered based on sender, sender reputation, recipient address, and content. You can also combine third-party antivirus and anti-spam solutions on the Edge Transport Server to provide a clean message stream into your organization. Smaller organizations may not implement Edge servers, preferring instead to use a hosted solution, like Microsoft Exchange Hosted Services. Once the message is deemed safe, the Edge passes it along to a hub transport server. The Edge server doesn't store any information other than the messages in transit, and those only very briefly. If you lose the Edge server, that will impact message delivery to and from the internet. We'll discuss how to provide protection against this eventuality later in the session. Connectors are defined on both the Edge transport and hub transport servers to route messages from the perimeter network into your intranet. Connectors are defined in pairs. For example, a send connector at the hub has a corresponding receive connector at the edge. Communications between the edge and hub are secure and authenticated by default. On arrival at the hub transport server, transport rules are applied to further filter the message. Consisting of conditions, actions, and exceptions, these rules enable you to create an ethical firewall that ensures inappropriate content does not enter or leave your organization. You can also use transport rules to maintain regulatory conformance. Legal regulations require that you store messages for search and retrieval on demand by the appropriate government agency. You may also have your own internal organization regulations that require disclaimers to be attached to all messages. The transport agents provided in Exchange, running on the Edge and Hub servers, allow you to easily conform to these regulations. You need to install at least one hub server in each Active Directory site that contains mailbox servers. Again, the hub server doesn't store messages other than while in transit to the edge or to a mailbox server. But if a hub server becomes unavailable, that would impact message routing. We'll discuss what you might do about this later. Our message is now sitting at the hub. The hub transport server now passes the message to the appropriate mailbox server. If the user is currently connected to the mailbox server from a MAPI client, such as Microsoft Outlook 2007, he or she is notified about the arrival of the new message. If the user is connected through Exchange ActiveSync, Outlook Web Access, or Outlook Anywhere, formerly known as RPC over HTTP, then the client access server is responsible for notifying the user. The mailbox server is the only server that stores messages. Loss of a mailbox database, however this is caused, will impact your organization. Mailbox servers can be protected through clustering. Later in today's session, we'll look at how you might use clustering to protect against data loss or unavailability. Moving back to the message in transit through the organization, the message is now retrieved by the remote client. The client access server can also ensure that remote users connect to a suitable client access server, one that is in the same site as their mailbox server. This can take the form of either a redirection, that is, telling the client which server to use, or proxying. You will also need one client access server in each Active Directory site that contains a mailbox server. If a client access server is unavailable to service remote client requests, then messages cannot be accessed by those remote clients. We'll discuss your options with regard to ensuring client access server availability later today. The last of the five server roles is the new Unified Messaging Server, which can link your PBX with your email. If a user is available, calls will be routed to telephones and faxes to fax machines. If the user is unavailable, an email message with the attached voice message will be placed in his or her mailbox. Outlook, OWA, and EAS clients provide in-message controls to hear and respond to these voice messages. Clearly, a failure in some elements of the voice messaging system could seriously impact your organization's telecommunications infrastructure. So later today, we'll look at what you can do to avoid this problem in the event of a unified messaging server failure. Having outlined the server roles, let's return to the agenda for a moment. In the second part of today's presentation, we'll look at what you need to protect from failure and how to protect things from failure and the effects of those failures. We'll start by discussing server installations. Whatever role or roles you have installed on a particular Exchange server computer, they all have something in common, which is that they are servers, with Exchange executables or binaries installed in the Program Files folder. Clearly, if these files become damaged or corrupted, Exchange cannot operate. In addition, some local configuration will take place when you install the server role. This configuration is stored mainly in the local registry, while other configuration is stored in Active Directory. By performing system state backups, you will back up both the binaries and any local registry settings or other localized configuration. You can use any appropriate backup restore method that suits you, so long as you back up the system state data. Let's look at where the configuration data exists. Aside from the local registry and other local configuration data, Active Directory contains the Exchange server configuration. Specifically, Active Directory contains the configuration for servers supporting the unified messaging, hub transport, client access, and mailbox server roles. The Edge server is a little different, in that Active Directory Application Mode, or ADAM, contains the configuration for the Edge server. To be clear about this, to enable the Edge server to pass messages to the appropriate hub server, the Edge requires recipient information. This is provided by an instance of ADAM. This is made available from a hub server over LDAP port 1389, and is read only at the Edge. You can determine how much information to provide in this way at the Edge. The Edge transport server ADAM is kept up to date using EdgeSync, a synchronization tool with the subset of Active Directory recipient information that you have made available. In addition to recipient data, some organizational and routing data is also required. ADAM runs as a non-operating system service and, as such, it does not require deployment on a domain controller. The primary benefit of running as a user service is that no domain controllers are needed in the Edge. This obviously has significant security benefits. You can find out more about ADAM at the Microsoft Windows Server 2003 website. To protect the server configuration, you will need to back up both Active Directory and the subset of Active Directory information that you have made available at the Edge. Active Directory exists on domain controllers, which you should back up regularly. Performing a system state backup of a domain controller will also back up Active Directory. Don't forget that Active Directory is a multi-master replicated database, and as such, multiple copies will exist, one installed on each domain controller that you deploy. This would allow for some recovery scenarios. However, you should always perform regular backups of Active Directory. To backup the Edge configuration, you can use the export Edge config shell script. This will ensure that the ADAM information is protected. It's worth noting that you can use the same shell script to create an installation source for additional Edge servers that you want to deploy with identical configurations. That's a real time saver when you come to deploy multiple front-end servers. We'll talk a little more about front-end load balancing later during today's session. End-user data exists in a number of locations. The first is in any SMTP queue. As messages transit the organization or pass through the Edge from the internet and then through to a hub transport server, they pass through dynamically created queues. In fact, even messages from users that are homed on the same mailbox server are processed in this way by the hub transport server, even if the hub role is deployed on the same server computer as the mailbox role. The second location for user data is the mailbox database. When a hub server determines the home database for a recipient object, the message is stored in a mailbox database. Thirdly, user data resides in public folders. If your organization relies on a public folder infrastructure to support legacy applications or to support free busy calendaring information for legacy Outlook clients, then some user data will be stored in these public folders. As message queues are created and deleted as necessary to support message flow, you should consider that data in the queues as transient. There is consequently no way to back up this data. In the event that a server fails and there are items in the queue, you must consider those items to be unrecoverable from that server computer. However, recovery is possible from elsewhere, depending upon circumstances and configuration. We'll come back to this transient data later. The most obvious way to protect your mailbox databases and public folder databases is to perform regular backup operations. You can then perform restores to recover lost or damaged databases. We will focus on the specifics of mailbox database backup and recovery later in today's session. Next, let's consider how to avoid some common problems arising from server failure by discussing load balancing, clustering, and data replication. In other words, how can you prevent a failure, like a disk failure or power supply failure, from becoming a disaster? Well, one possible solution is load balancing. Out in the perimeter network, you will have deployed your edge servers. As they do not contain any stateful data, that is, data that resides on the server, you can best provide fault tolerance for this role by using load balancing. Install multiple edge servers with identical configurations, and in the event of a single or even multiple server failures, you can be sure that some edge servers will remain to service internet mail. A side benefit with this approach is that you will have enhanced performance in busy environments, as multiple servers can service requests simultaneously, improving throughput at the edge. For smaller businesses that cannot afford multiple servers at the edge, or that are not even planning to implement edge servers, consider using a third-party hosting service that offers the services provided by Edge. We will be looking at such a solution later in today's session. As we move into the intranet, both the client access and hub transport roles support load balancing automatically. Simply place multiple client access and hub transport servers in each Active Directory site, and load balancing will be established. Another relevant note is that because the client access services need to be made available from the internet, you will need to publish these services using ISA server. We won't go into the precise details here, but clearly you will need to ensure that sufficient resilience exists for the ISA servers. Otherwise, the client access services will not be accessible in the event of an ISA server failure. ISA servers reside in the perimeter network. Finally, you will need to consider some sort of fault tolerance for the mailbox server role. The mailbox server role hosts stateful data, and as such is not suited for load balancing. Each server contains different data, and users must connect to their own specific server. There are two possible solutions to the problem of providing high availability on the mailbox server role. The first of these is data replication. In data replication, fault tolerance is provided by copying data from one location to another in the event that the primary location becomes unavailable. Exchange Server 2007 now supports log shipping as a way of providing an up-to-the-moment backup of a storage group to guard against storage group and database failures. As you are probably aware, transaction log files are used in Exchange Server to hold changes that are about to be made to the databases in a given storage group. These logs contain a record of all changes made to the databases since the last normal backup. If you take a copy of a storage group, all that's needed to synchronize the databases it contains with a live system is to replay the log files against the copy. That is the basis of both LCR and CCR. As you are also probably aware, performing a restore operation is a time-consuming process, and if we can reduce the situations where we need to perform them, that's got to be a good thing. The Exchange product group looked at the information about when and why restores were being done, and they discovered that the most common reason for performing a restore was a disk drive failure. All bearings in a disk drive wear out every couple of years, and people have to look to backup to recover. Log shipping is a great way to get around that because it's a continuous replication. Each log file is played back against a duplicate storage group's databases, so you always have a live copy of the databases available in case a disk drive fails. In some ways, LCR is like a locally stored mirror of the database. However, there are situations where the other failures can cause the databases to become unavailable. If your server power supply goes out, having a local copy of the databases won't help. CCR was designed for two computers to support a complete server failure and therefore addresses this problem. You create a copy of the databases on another computer and log shipping keeps them synchronized. It's been designed so that those servers can also be in two different physical sites, geographically separate if you want, to have insurance against site failure, and this is all built into Exchange 2007. A side benefit of having multiple copies of a database at all times is that when you do perform backup operations, you can do so on the standby database, which will reduce the performance impact on your users. And although LCR and CCR reduce the likelihood of having to perform a restore operation after a disk failure, they also reduce the number of backups that you need to perform. Note that performing a backup of the standby database requires that you use VSS backup solutions. The NT Backup Streaming Online Backup can only back up the live database. Next, we'll review each of these technologies. By reducing the number of backup operations, the cost of performing backups and maintaining archives is reduced. Administrators are always looking for ways to reduce costs, and LCR can provide a reduction in the total cost of ownership of Exchange. Although you cannot guard against all forms of data loss, with LCR you can protect against the most common, loss of a storage group through the loss of the underlying disk, and you won't even need to perform a restore. Backups do not provide fault tolerance. They provide a means to recover lost data. A system that can continue to operate after a failure of a component is said to be fault tolerant. With LCR, your server will continue to operate even if a disk fails, provided you have everything in place. Log files and correct disk configurations have always given the ability to recover to the point of failure. And now, with log shipping, you can achieve a higher level of resilience. Simply stated, you need to perform far fewer backups. Previously, when a disk failed, you would need to replace it, perform a restore of the storage group, and then replay the logs since the last backup. Now you don't need to do anything, at least not immediately. The system is still running. Let's summarize the benefits of CCR and see how it takes reliability and recovery to the next level. CCR has all the benefits that LCR does, but includes a few more. Because Exchange Server 2007 only supports active-passive cluster configurations, there is no single point of failure. This makes the cluster more fault-tolerant. The more reliable your messaging system, the easier things will be for you. You don't have to install the cluster on shared storage devices. Because of this, CCR supports a wider range of storage. And you don't have to install on shared storage, which means the requirements for the server hardware are less stringent. Nor do you have to select hardware from the cluster category in the Windows Server Catalog. As long as the servers in the cluster are comparable, that's all you need to worry about. With Exchange Server 2007, you can create a cluster that spans multiple data centers, without the need for third-party software. Everything you need is built into Exchange. The Exchange product group has unified the cluster installation process with the standard mailbox server role installation, so no specialized knowledge is required to install CCR. It's quick and easy to set up. And all cluster-specific related management tasks are hidden underneath the associated generic Exchange Server Management task. For example, when you perform storage group reconfiguration, Exchange Server performs the related CCR management tasks for you. Because CCR creates a second copy of databases on a passive node, the passive node can be used to offload the effect of doing regular backups. For example, by doing backups on the passive node, the backup window could be extended and the I/O load is no longer on the active node. Instead of, or in addition to data replication, you can consider clustering. Broadly speaking, a cluster is a collection of two or more servers, referred to as nodes, that access shared information. In Exchange, the shared information would be the mailbox databases and associated resources. In the event that a node fails, the remaining nodes will take over the assigned tasks of the failed node. Clustering solutions typically fall into one of two categories. First, active-active configurations comprising two nodes, both with assigned tasks. In the event of a node failure, the remaining node starts to run the additional tasks of the failed node. This has performance implications during a failover. Second, active-passive configurations, comprising two or more nodes, one of which is always idle or redundant, but ready to take over any assigned tasks of a failed member of the cluster. This offers benefits in terms of performance during failover and is the preferred solution for clustering based on Microsoft technologies. Clustering can provide a high level of fault tolerance, particularly when combined with other fault tolerance strategies at the component level, disks, power supplies, and so on. However, clustering requires a significant investment in hardware and may be out of the budgetary scope for some smaller organizations. Single copy clusters provides a clustered solution for Exchange Server 2007. SCC uses a single copy of a storage group on storage media that is shared between the nodes in the cluster. SCC is similar to clustering in previous versions of Exchange Server, with some significant changes and improvements. Both LCR and CCR rely on duplicate copies of a storage group and do not share hardware. Single copy Exchange clusters require the use of a shared nothing architecture. In this architecture, although all nodes in the cluster can access shared data, they cannot access it at the same time. For example, if a physical disk resource is assigned to node 1 of a two-node cluster, node 2 cannot access the disk resource until node 1 is taken offline, fails, or the disk resource is moved to node 2 manually. Windows communicates with resources in a cluster by using a resource DLL. Exchange 2007 provides its own custom resource DLL to communicate with the cluster service. Communication between the cluster service and Exchange 2007 is customized to provide Windows cluster functionality. Exchange 2007 uses Windows cluster groups to contain Exchange virtual servers in a cluster. A clustered mailbox server is a Windows cluster group containing cluster resources, such as an IP address, one or more physical disk resources, the Exchange system attendant resource, and other Exchange resources. Clustered mailbox servers include Windows cluster service resources, such as IP address resources, network name resources, and physical disk resources. Clustered mailbox servers also include their own Exchange-specific resources. When creating a clustered mailbox server, Exchange automatically creates the other essential Exchange-related resources, such as an HTTP virtual server instance and an information store instance. Perhaps the significant thing to remember when planning to use SCC is that the nodes must share storage. This is not a requirement of either LCR or CCR. In addition, the server computers themselves must meet more stringent requirements. For Exchange 2007 cluster nodes running on Windows Server 2003 Enterprise or Data Center editions, you must select from hardware listed in the Windows Server Catalog under the Cluster Solutions category. This is not necessary for implementing either LCR or CCR. All of these fault tolerance strategies can benefit from additional component-based fault tolerance. Simple component failure, such as parts of the network infrastructure, routers, hubs, wiring even, can cause significant service availability issues. It's important to make sure that these basics are all in place, as well as to consider the bigger picture, clustering, replication, and so forth. You need to minimize single points of failure in your network infrastructure. Exchange Server is incredibly smart when it comes to message routing, and doesn't require a routing group infrastructure to reroute in the event of infrastructure failures, but uses the physical IP topology to determine the best route available. Make sure you consider power outages and interruptions and internal power supply failures. At all times, you need to look at your hardware and ask yourself, if this component failed, what would the impact be? Then, mitigate by providing component redundancy. There is no more important area for this consideration than storage. Let's focus on storage considerations for a moment. Before we detail the storage requirements for each of the server roles, let's run through what you will find on a given server. The Windows Server 2003 operating system and its paging file. The Exchange database, made up of transaction logs, the ESE database itself, and the Exchange TMP folder. Both of the Exchange 2007 Edge Transport Server and Hub Transport Server store email in special ESE database, essentially the mail queues. On the Hub Transport Server, incoming mail from the internet is converted to MAPI prior to being delivered. This content conversion process occurs in the TMP folder. The minimum configuration to provide adequate availability is to place the operating system, TMP folder, and paging file on a 2-disk RAID 1 volume. The transaction logs and ESE database should be on another RAID 1 volume. It's worth noting that to improve performance, you can further separate these components. For example, the database could be placed onto a separate volume from the transaction logs. Likewise, the TMP folder could be placed on a different volume from the paging file and the operating system. The client access server will be sufficiently protected if you place the various elements on a single RAID 1 volume. However, for performance reasons, you should consider separate RAID 1 volumes to host the operating system, paging file, logs, and TMP folder. The unified messaging server storage configurations should be similar to the client access server, with sufficient resilience achieved through a single mirrored volume. Bear in mind that unified messaging fault tolerance is provided through the deployment of additional unified messaging servers and the unified messaging services configuration. For the mailbox server, the operating system and paging file should be placed on a single volume built on a 2-disk RAID 1 volume. The transaction logs should be placed on a RAID 1 volume, this time comprising 6 physical disks. For reliability and performance, the logs are placed on a different volume than the databases. The ESE databases should be placed on a RAID 10 array, comprising a minimum of 20 disks. RAID 10 provides the same fault tolerance as RAID 1, but significantly higher I/O is achieved by striping the mirrored segments. If you consider component-level failure as well as think about server-level fault tolerance, you can hopefully prevent a failure from becoming a disaster. Let's return to the agenda. No matter how good your fault-tolerant protection, failures will occur, and you need to plan how to resolve a failure before it becomes a disaster. In this section, we'll consider how you can do that. Let's start by considering the impact of the loss of a database. It is possible, even though you may have a storage group replica, to still lose a database. For example, if a database becomes corrupted, LCR and CCR will not replicate the corruption. However, if your organization is impacted by a virus that generates a lot of superfluous traffic and messages, causing database problems, LCR and CCR will replicate that. Because of this, it is important that you plan for this eventuality. Always perform regular backups. Exchange Server 2007 supports much larger mailbox databases, and you need to think carefully about the frequency and type of mailbox database backup. Daily full backups can be time-consuming and can impact performance. Ensure that your ESE database and transaction logs are on different physical volumes. In the event of a database loss, you can recover the database from the last backup, and the transaction logs will be replayed into the database during the server database mount. By using replication, performing appropriate backups, and separating the database from the transaction logs, you can protect your databases against loss. Let's think about what will happen when a server fails. Careful planning could mitigate against server loss. For example, if you ensure that every Active Directory site that contains a mailbox server also contains two client access servers and two hub transport servers, you have achieved load balancing and failover support for these two roles. Always install multiple edge transport servers in the perimeter network to ensure ongoing internet mail routing. Consider the use of clustering for protecting the mailbox servers from machine loss. Unified messaging services can be protected if you configure multiple gateways on your PBX. Then you can set up a hunt group so that if a gateway is offline, the PBX would find another one that's operational. If a unified messaging server fails, you could configure multiple unified messaging servers in the Exchange site that would handle requests in case one of them were to fail. Once any server has failed, you need to decide whether to rebuild the server. It's not always necessary. For example, a hub transport server is a routing engine with the routing information and most other configuration data stored in Active Directory. You need not expend any great effort recovering that particular server, but could instead install a new server. This is even true of the mailbox server role, as although it contains important user data, and you may need to recover that data, you don't necessarily need to recover it in place, as we'll see shortly. What other disasters should you prepare for? There are a number of other situations that you might face. These include losing a server's configuration data. Most configuration data for all but the Edge server is stored in Active Directory. So long as you back that up, you're reasonably well protected. Whatever local data exists in the server roles can be backed up with the system state backup option. As we saw earlier, you can export the Edge server configuration and use this to rebuild a new Edge server. Only the mailbox server role supports clustering. If you install your mailbox into a cluster, then that mailbox server is highly protected, but not invulnerable. Consider what would happen if you lost all the nodes, that is, the whole cluster. What would the impact be? So long as you have adequate backup, you can always rebuild the server. And ultimately, with some of the recovery tools we'll see shortly, you don't necessarily need to rebuild the server. You can shift the databases it supported to another server, perhaps temporarily. The worst case scenario must be the consideration of losing the entire data center. In essence, this still comes down to the fundamentals. What data was held where? Where's the backup? What recovery options do we consider? What happens to data waiting for delivery? Before we consider the answer to these questions, let's return to the agenda once more. In this last section, we're going to have a look at the disaster recovery tools that Exchange Server 2007 provides. Before we do, a quick word about hosted services. With the acquisition of FrontBridge and the launch of Microsoft Exchange Hosted Services, Microsoft can also provide a tightly integrated hosted package for users who want it. This is of special interest to SMEs who want the protection of a clean message stream, the safety of a disaster recovery infrastructure, and help with archiving and regulatory compliance, but perhaps don't have the budget or IT infrastructure to provide this in-house. But they could use hosted services and have all that handled for them. Exchange Hosted Services consists of four services. Exchange Hosted Filtering provides antivirus, anti-spam filtering, policy enforcement, and disaster recovery. Multiple antivirus engines sweep messages addressed to your organization. These antivirus engines update with new virus definitions continuously, protecting against new virus outbreaks. Multiple anti-spam engines, assisted around the clock by anti-spam experts, continually monitor email addressed to your organization. The engine routes spam to a quarantine folder for optional inspection. You can configure email notification as new content arrives in the quarantined folder. Exchange Hosted Filtering helps you conform to government regulations regarding email. You can use the Policy Rule Writer to define policies to monitor and manage emails on any aspect of the message metadata, including specific text patterns, sender, originating IP, and other attributes. The service also can ensure that if you lose your internet connection to your email server, you will not lose any email messages. The service queues email for up to 5 days, and when your email server is back online, the Exchange Hosted Filtering service forwards the queued messages. Exchange Hosted Archive provides message archives and search facilities and message continuity for when your own server is down. The Exchange Hosted Archive captures and copies email messages that pass through the Exchange Hosted Services network, either on their way to or from your organization. Powerful search tools enable you to perform message search and retrieval when necessary. The Exchange Hosted Archive also benefits from the antivirus and anti-spam features of the Hosted Filtering service. Aside from archive capabilities, the service can also provide messaging continuity when your email system is unavailable. Your users can use the web-based interface to work with email until your system is back online. Exchange Hosted Filtering service defines rules for encrypting messages in transit from your organization. Messages flow to the service gateway through a transport layer security encrypted tunnel. Upon arrival at the gateway, the service manages the processes of issuing a private key to the recipient of a message and of making the key available when the recipient decrypts the message. These processes are entirely transparent to the originator of the message. When a recipient receives an encrypted message, he or she completes a simple process with the Exchange Hosted Encryption Service to verify the recipient's identity. This process is transparent to the originator of the message. Lastly, Exchange Hosted Continuity provides rollback and recovery solutions and message continuity. The service makes a 30-day rolling email repository available by using the Exchange Hosted Archive Store. If your internet connection or email server fails at any time, your users can access this repository to work with their email until your system is back online. You can perform restore operations from the rolling repository should you need to do so. With the combination of hosted services and Exchange 2007, you can have the best of both worlds. Let's look at mailbox recovery options now. During the session, we've identified that the only piece of significant user data is the mailbox database. In the past, your recovery options probably amounted to performing an in-place restore of the mailbox to the original server that homed it. Well, that can be time-consuming, and while you're consuming that time, your users are probably unable to get any work done. So, Exchange 2007 provides some additional options. First, a feature known as database portability. You can perform a mailbox database restore to another working server. There is nothing in the database object name that indicates the server that it belongs on. So if you don't have the time or intention of recovering a failed server, then restore its mailboxes to another server. This restore can be from a backup tape or from a simple copy of the database files. You then need to use the move mailbox configuration only command from the Windows PowerShell to update Active Directory with the change in recipient information before users connect to their mailboxes. The Microsoft Office Outlook 2007 client then updates its service profile about the home server for the user by using the Auto Discover service from the client access server. Outlook Web Access users don't have a profile, of course, and always connect to their appropriate mailbox server, even when you have just moved the database that homes their mailbox. Second, you can use the alternate server dial tone feature. This was available in Exchange 2003, but has been extended in 2007. For those of you unfamiliar with dial tone access, it works like this. You don't have the mailbox database to restore, or you don't have time to perform the restore, but users want to send and receive email. So you have a standby server that you move their mailboxes to, again, with the move mailbox configuration only command. So although they can't access the current mailbox content, users can generate new messages and read new messages as they arrive. In time, you can recover the mailbox data. As with database portability, Outlook 2007 clients will have their profile updated automatically by using Auto Discover. Finally, the Recovery Storage Group, or RSG. This was introduced in 2003 to support the dial tone recovery method, enabling you to restore the mailbox to the Recovery Storage Group while your users continued to work off the dial tone database. Then you could move the contents from the RSG to the dial tone database. The problem in 2003 was that this did not easily support recovery of a mailbox database, or specifically the mailboxes within a database, to another server. So RSG has been updated to support this facility. There's also support for filtering or merging mailboxes with the restore mailbox shell command, and support for deleted and moved mailboxes. Exchange 2007 also provides additional recovery strategies. If a server has failed, and you intend to build a new server on new hardware, you can use the new setup/m:recover-server command. This claims the server configuration from Active Directory and allows you to rebuild the old server. This command, unlike its equivalent in 2003, supports the ability to enable standby clusters. To use this command on a cluster, use the setup/m:recover-server/recover-cms command. One note, you cannot use this command to rebuild your Edge server. The recovery on an Edge server is a clean installation followed by importing the previously exported Edge configuration. There are some handy new utilities in the Exchange 2007 toolbox. First, there's the Database Troubleshooter tool, which can analyze event logs and search for known issues, for example, running out of disk space, log generation, reaching database size limit, and possible database corruption. Second, there is the Database Recovery Management tool. This tool provides support for the Recovery Storage Group, supports mailbox extraction, and provides access to database recovery tools such as ESEutil and IsInteg. Exchange Server 2007 makes a number of improvements in the storage database to aid recovery. These include support for 50 storage groups and, by implication, 50 databases. It's important to remember that recovery best practices indicate that you should limit the number of databases per storage group to one. This is because it is far quicker to back up and restore many smaller databases than a few larger databases. Also, consider the requirement to restore a single mailbox. That's quicker when the databases are comparatively small. The 1-to-1 ratio is also a requirement to support both LCR and CCR. Increased number of log files. In Exchange Server 2003, the transaction log file names had only 5 characters to indicate the sequence of the log file. For example, E01000001.log. Exchange Server 2003 increases the number of log files associated with a storage group by a factor of 2000 by allowing 8 characters. Log files provide the primary mechanism for data replay for a storage group. Simplified database structure. The requirement for a separate streaming content file, or .stm, for the mailbox and public stores has been removed. This change makes it easier for you to perform database restore operations because the database structure is simpler. Let's look at database backup and restore issues. Exchange Server 2007 supports both volume shadow copy, VSS-based backups, and the more traditional online streaming backups. The major benefit of VSS backups is the relative speed of recovery of the data that you want to restore. Elements within the VSS framework, known as requesters, writers, and providers, communicate to create and restore volume shadow copies. The ability to perform fast restores is dependent on the capabilities of the provider. A software-based provider and a general file system writer are included in Windows Server 2003, and although Windows Backup can use these VSS components to perform general file system shadow copy backups, Exchange Server has specific backup and restore requirements that the general file system writer can't handle. For this reason, you will need to use third-party provided VSS components to backup and restore Exchange using VSS. We discussed both LCR and CCR earlier in today's session. To some extent, replicating storage groups negates the need to perform so many backup operations. In Exchange 2003, you would need to perform regular normal backups, perhaps as frequently as daily, to protect the database against data loss. Now you can combine a weekly normal backup and daily incremental backups and have the same, if not better, level of protection against data loss. The other major issue is that when you need to perform a restore, under Exchange Server 2003, you need an identically built server to which to restore your database. As we've seen already today, Exchange 2007 supports a restore of a database to any running server. Let's return to VSS for a moment. In Exchange Server 2003, VSS backup supported only a single storage group at a time. This limitation has been removed in Exchange Server 2007, enabling you to backup multiple storage groups using VSS backup methods. You can also perform a VSS restore to any path, and don't need to restore back to the original location. The VSS system can also verify, before the restore takes place, whether the database that you're restoring is going to mount successfully after restoration. If it isn't likely to mount, an error is raised, and you can avoid wasting your time attempting a futile restore operation. You also have the option to run recovery when the restore is finished, but the database mount takes an extended period. You can let the restore finish when the database is mountable. Finally, you can now restore to the recovery storage group, or to an alternate server. It's time for the session demonstration. In this demo, we'll move a mailbox using the configuration only switch to demonstrate how to establish dial tone access. Move a mailbox to provide dial tone access. Let's imagine that a database is unavailable. You anticipate that the database will be available later today, but in the interim, users need the ability to send and receive email. You decide not to recover the database onto another server or into the recovery storage group. Instead, you opt to give the users dial tone access to an empty database on another server. Let's connect to Spencer's mailbox to verify that it has some contents. We can see some messages here. And some appointments in the calendar. We'll just disconnect from OWA. We'll use the move mailbox command from the shell to enable the dial tone access. Let's open the Exchange Management shell. At the command prompt, we'll use the move mailbox command and specify the mailbox Spencer Low for demonstration purposes. If you needed to move all mailboxes, you could just select the ones you wanted with get mailbox and the criteria you wanted to select by, database name probably, and then pipe the selection through to the move mailbox command. We need to specify a target database, which is our dial tone database, by using the target database switch. Then we specify the configuration only switch because we don't want to move the content across. In our scenario, of course, the database is unavailable anyway. Then confirm the action. Now let's open OWA again and ensure that Spencer can access email services even though his content is unavailable. Bear in mind that if Spencer was accessing his mailbox through Microsoft Office Outlook 2007, he could still access his content assuming cached mode was enabled, which is the default behavior on the 2007 client. Also consider that legacy clients, like Outlook 2003, will be attempting to locate Spencer's mailbox on the unavailable server. This is not an issue with either OWA, as we have demonstrated, or with Outlook 2007, as both can utilize AutoDiscover to determine the location of the user's database. In this demo, we'll see LCR in action. In this demo, we'll establish and test LCR. We'll send a large message to generate some traffic in the logs and verify that the replication of these logs has occurred. Let's look at how quickly and easily you can enable local continuous replication. We'll perform this task from the console. Navigate to the Server Configuration Work Center and use the Manage Mailbox role in the action to jump to the right place. Click the link in the Action pane to enable local continuous backup. We need to specify a path for the system files first. Then we need to specify a path for the system files. Finally, we need to define a location for the existing databases within the storage group. Remember that LCR operates at the storage group level by using log shipping. Microsoft recommends that you only define one database per storage group. In fact, you cannot enable LCR on a storage group with more than one database. Then we complete the process. To verify setup, we can view the status of the storage group in the Exchange Management console. We just open the properties of the storage group and click the Local Continuous Backup tab. A copy has started. In addition, we can also use Windows Explorer to check for the presence of the database and log files. They are all present, so that appears to have been successful. There isn't much in the log folder now, so we'll check back when we have sent some messages. We'll now generate some log activity to test that LCR is functioning correctly and to ensure that the replica has healthy status. Let's send that message to Claire. Now let's check the log files in the replica log folder. The local continuous replication process has added new log files. This demonstrates that LCR is functioning correctly. Let's look at the recovery tools in the next demo. In this demo, we'll move a database. First, we'll perform a VSS snapshot backup of the replica database. Then we'll move the files across to a new server. Finally, we'll use the move mailbox command with the configuration only switch to move remaining users from SMBEX01 database to the newly deployed EXBE01 server. During this demonstration, we will complete the process of moving a database from one server to another. Remember, in Exchange Server 2007, there is nothing in the database name that indicates to which server it belongs. Consequently, you can restore a database to another server. We'll be using a Volume Shadow Copy Writer utility to take a snapshot backup of our mailbox database, but we'll perform the backup from the replica of the database, which will affect users significantly less than performing their backup from the active copy of the database. The utility is called BETest and is available as part of the VSS SDK. However, this is an internal Exchange product group version. We have a batch file here that calls the BETest program and executes the stored backup procedure. We'll just run the batch file now. It'll take a moment to create the snapshot. The replica logs are stored in C:\disk1 logs, and the database is in C:\disk1 DB. We can compare these files to those of the snapshot backup. Let's move to the folder in which the snapshot files are stored. First, the database files. Next, we can verify the logs. A snapshot backup appears to have been successful. Remember that this is a backup of the replica, and so the backup operation has not affected users. If we used VSS to take snapshots of the CCR replica, we'd see even less impact in terms of performance degradation. In the next part of the demonstration, we will restore, or rather copy, the snapshot to another server. To do this, we need to enable restores on the database in question and dismount it. We'll do that from the shell, as it's quicker than using the console. Just use the dismount database command and, in quotes, specify the name of the database exbe01/mailbox database because the database is on server exbe01. We confirm that operation. Next, by using the set mailbox database command, we can enable file restore operations. We use the allow file restore switch and set the value to $true. Next, we'll simply navigate using Windows Explorer to the folder that contains the storage group database files and logs onto the EXBE01 server. We'll delete all the log files, the CHK file, and of course the database file. Now we'll switch to the replica folder, select all the logs, and copy them. Switch back to the first storage group folder over on EXBE01 and paste the logs here. Then switch to the replica backup of the database, copy those files, and then switch back to the EXBE01 server and paste the files. Now we'll try to mount the EXBE01 mailbox database. Remember the process so far. We created a local replica of SMBEX01 first storage group. We used a VSS snapshot utility to take a backup of the replica. We then dismounted the EXBE01 mailbox database and copied the backup files into the appropriate folders. In essence, we are restoring the database to another server and providing database portability. We haven't had to rebuild the original server or do anything other than copy the database files across and mount the target database. Let's do that now. We'll switch back to the shell because it's quicker. We simply use the mount database command, specify the database name, and then confirm the operation. Next, we should test that the restore moved the content across correctly. We'll do that by connecting to Spencer's mailbox using OWA. First, let's change the mailbox configuration for users that are still homed on SMBEX01 mailbox database. Again, we'll use the shell command move mailbox and the configuration only switch. Because we only want to move selected users, we start by using getMailbox and piping that to a selective clause. In this case, we use the where object command and select those mailboxes currently homed on SMBEX01. Finally, we pipe the result of the selection to the move mailbox command, specifying the target database as the EXBE01 mailbox database and using the configuration only switch. We confirm the operation. While that's taking place, just think. You could use this same procedure for moving mailboxes. Back up the database, restore it to an alternate server, perhaps a newly deployed server, then use the move mailbox configuration only command to move the mailboxes. Now let's open two mailboxes through Outlook Web Access. Remember that legacy Outlook clients, such as Outlook 2003, will need the administrator to change their local Outlook profile to point to the new server. That's not necessary with Outlook 2007 or OWA, as both use auto-discover services to locate the mailbox. We'll connect as Spencer, and then we'll open OWA as Holly. They both have mailbox content, so the database seems to be portable. Let's return to the presentation. Let's move on to a demo using the Recovery Storage Group in Exchange Server 2007. In this demo, we'll use the Recovery Storage Group to recover lost data. We'll use both the shell and console to create and manage the RSG, and use streaming backup and restore to move data from a failing database to the RSG. In this demonstration, we will use the Database Recovery Management tool to create and manage a recovery storage group. We will also use the Exchange Management shell to create and mount a database within the recovery storage group. We will then back up the active copy of the first storage group using a streaming backup program and restore the mailbox database to the recovery storage group. We'll start from the console toolbox. We'll load the Database Recovery Management tool. Since we don't have an internet connection from this virtual machine, we will ask the tool to go straight to the welcome screen. Let's enter an identifying label of Create RSG for this task, and then specify the server, SMBEX01, and a domain controller for the task. Ask the tool to start collecting Active Directory information. In the task list, we can choose to troubleshoot a database mount problem, analyze log file space, show database-related event logs, and create a recovery storage group. It's this last option we want. A server can only support a single recovery storage group. We specify which storage group will be linked to the recovery storage group. It can only be one. We'll choose First Storage Group. Then we define the recovery storage group name, in this case RSG, and specify where the logs and system files will be stored. We'll use Disk 2 and use the logs and DB subfolders. We'll return to the tasks list later in the demonstration and just minimize the tool for now. Let's move the console out of the way too. In this part of the demonstration, we will use NT Backup to perform a streaming backup of the active copy of the first storage group. We'll open the backup program from Accessories System Tools. We'll use the advanced mode rather than the wizard. Let's just select the first storage group, enter a suitable location to store the backup, and then click Start Backup. We'll enter the description, First Storage Group Backup, replace any existing media, and launch the backup job. That's completed without incident, so we'll close the dialog box and minimize the backup program for a moment. Next, we will need to configure the mailbox database in the first storage group to allow file restore, which we'll do from the shell. We use the set database command and, in quotes, the name of the database, followed by the allow file restore switch with the value of $true. This will enable us to merge or copy mailboxes from the RSG when we need to later in the demo. Now we are ready to perform the restore. But first, we need to create a database in the recovery storage group. In this part of the demo, we will create a database in the recovery storage group to which we can restore the backed up mailbox database. Again, we'll do this from the shell. Let's start by using the new mailbox database command and specifying the mailbox database to recover switch. This allows us to define the mailbox database as the database that we will recover. Then we use the storage group switch to define RSG as the storage group to which we will add the new database. Finally, we use the EDB file path switch to define the location for this database. We'll place the database in the same folder that we place the system files for the RSG recovery storage group. We'll just set the allow file restore option on the RSG database. It should be set already, as that's the default for a database in a recovery storage group. We'll use the set mailbox database command, as before. Let's switch back to the backup utility. We'll just click the Restore and Manage Media tab, expand the backup we just created, and select the mailbox database to restore. Click Start Restore, specify a location for log and patch files, and then specify that this is the last restore set. Click OK to start the restore process. The Restore Process dialog box tells us that the restore to the recovery storage group was successful. Let's mount the recovered database. We'll switch back to the shell and use the mount database command. That will take a second. Let's see what mailboxes we have in the recovery database. We'll use the Get Mailbox Statistics command to do that. We'll format the output for display name. For demonstration purposes, we'll restore Terry Adams' mailbox. We use the Restore Mailbox command. Specify which mailbox, in this case Terry Adams, and then use the switch RSG database to specify the name of the recovery database we want to use. You can easily restore multiple mailboxes with Get Mailbox Statistics database and the database name in quotes, and pipe the result to the restore mailbox command. You can even recover a mailbox into a folder on an active mailbox, perhaps because someone left the organization and you need the mailbox content in his or her replacement's mailbox. Of course, you can also do this through the console, but the shell is quicker. Let's look at a summary of today's session. Let's run through a summary of today's session. During the session, we covered how to plan for disaster recovery in Exchange Server 2007. We learned about each server role and the impact of a failure in a given server role within your organization. We learned that by using load balancing, clustering, and data replication, we can protect against server failures. We looked at the issue of component failure and spent some time identifying the recommended disconfigurations for the various server roles. We learned that to prevent a failure from becoming a disaster, you must understand the typical problems that you might face. We also examined possible solutions to those problems. We saw that in the event of failure, Exchange Server 2007 provides a number of mailbox and other recovery tools so that you can get the server up and running as quickly as possible. For the most comprehensive technical information on Microsoft products, visit the TechNet website at www.microsoft.com/technet. You can also visit www.microsoft.com/technet/exc-113 for more information on books, courses, certifications, and other community resources that relate directly to this particular session. There are a number of other resources that are available from Microsoft. These books can be found at all major bookstores and online retailers. Microsoft also has instructor-led courses if you prefer the classroom-style environment. Microsoft Learning develops courseware called Microsoft Official Curriculum, or MOC, which includes e-learning, Microsoft Pressbooks, workshops, clinics, and Microsoft Skills Assessment. MOC is offered in instructor-led environments and offers comprehensive training courses for IT professionals in supporting and implementing solutions using Microsoft products and technologies. The course that best supports this session is Getting Started with Microsoft Exchange Server 2007 Clinic, which is available now. For more information, please visit www.microsoft.com/learning. There is also an assessment program available that can help you test your knowledge. Microsoft Skills Assessment is a free online learning tool. It's an easy way for IT professionals to check their skills. You can quickly check your skills for implementing or managing Microsoft products or business solutions. Just take a short 30-question assessment and see how well you know your stuff. The skills assessment includes a personalized learning plan, which includes links to Microsoft Official Curriculum, specific TechNet articles, Microsoft Press books, and other Microsoft Learning content. There's also a way to measure how well you did compared with others who took the same assessment. Microsoft Skills Assessment is an expanding learning platform. Available now are assessments for Windows Server 2003, including security and patch management, Exchange Server 2003, Windows Storage Server, Office 2003, and VisualStudio.net. If you want to take your skills assessment to the next level, a number of certification programs are available. In the highly competitive IT job market, how can you differentiate yourself from the next candidate? The Microsoft certification program provides that edge. Earning a specific accreditation provides objective validation of the ability to successfully perform critical IT functions. Embraced by industry professionals worldwide, Microsoft certification remains one of the most effective ways to reach long-term career goals, and is a surefire way for companies to develop and retain valuable IT staff. There are a number of accreditations available, starting with the basic Microsoft Certified Professional, or MCP. You can choose to go and become a fully certified Systems Administrator, MSCA, or System Engineer, MCSE, or a Desktop Specialist, MCDST. Away from the infrastructure side, the MCDBA certification covers the SQL Server products. For more information about the certification program, visit www.microsoft.com/learning/MCP. This session was brought to you by TechNet. TechNet has gone through some changes recently, which I'm sure you'll find interesting to hear about. To help explain this in more detail, here's Ian Brackenbury, TechNet Subscription Product Manager.
TechNet Plus Subscription introduces its newest offering, TechNet Plus Direct. With TechNet Plus Direct, subscribers get all of the benefits of TechNet Plus for 30% less. Subscribers receive fast, easy access to the tools and information they need to get the most out of Microsoft solutions. A subscription provides IT professionals with immediate online access to all the essential technical resources they need to resolve technical issues faster, get hands-on experience with the latest Microsoft technologies, and build technical skills. Subscribers now get immediate access to all their subscription features in one convenient location, our new online benefits portal. Subscribers get access through subscriber download to Microsoft full version software for evaluation and beta releases without time or feature limits. No more waiting for media shipments. This includes Microsoft Server, client, and application software titles. With full version software, subscribers can make informed decisions about new technologies and deployments at their own pace. For the toughest technical questions, a TechNet Plus subscription also comes with two complimentary professional support incidents. Subscribers can talk to a Microsoft support professional to quickly resolve their mission-critical technical issues fast. TechNet Plus also provides access to over 100 managed news groups. Subscribers can exchange ideas with other professionals and get expert answers to their technical questions within the next business day, guaranteed. In addition, subscribers can also chat with a Microsoft Search Assistant online for help finding the technical resources they need or for assistance with non-technical questions. Subscribers also get access to technical information and tools, including the TechNet Plus library containing the knowledge base, security updates, service packs, resource kits, and more. TechNet Plus offers proven value that far exceeds its cost. The two complimentary professional support incidents alone more than offset the cost of a TechNet Plus subscription. Add to that the evaluation and beta software and other technical resources, and TechNet Plus clearly boosts productivity. Every IT professional on the team needs one. TechNet Plus is available exclusively online without media shipments. For more information, please visit technet.microsoft.com/subscriptions. There are a number of free community resources available on TechNet. You can attend a regular chat with members of the product groups or technology specialists from Microsoft, or you can attend a webcast where you can see sessions like the one you've just watched, but presented live and with the ability to ask questions as you go. You can also read or post questions in public news groups. The news group page lists the available groups and provides an interface from which you can read and post messages. TechNet Plus subscribers can use these groups to post questions, and through their subscription ID, are guaranteed a response from Microsoft support professionals and IT experts by the next business day. The main community site provides a comprehensive list of resources available, more than we can cover on this slide, and the page has some dynamic features with continually updated content. The events page provides dates and details about attending a live TechNet event. These events take place around the world and provide the opportunity for you to talk to Microsoft specialists face-to-face. And finally, the TechNet columns provide a variety of topics written by industry authors. And with that, thank you for taking the time to listen to this TechNet session.